CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Welcome to the September 14th edition of Dromotext. Tonight we have a one-hour presentation of the Nobel Prize-winning author's work, Wole Soyinka. It's a reading of his poems entitled Samarkand and Other Markets I Have Known. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1986, the first African to receive the prize. He's an author of extraordinarily large number of books, comedies, philosophy, plays, and literary criticism. And so here we'll hear tonight Soyinka reading from his work, Samarkand and Other Markets I Have Known. Here he is, Wole Soyinka.
Last time I was asked to introduce Wole Soyinka, someone in the audience told me afterwards, I think I liked some of the things you said, but you were there for too long. So I tried to avoid doing that by putting down my introduction so as to discipline myself. Elsewhere, if Wole Soyinka was to be introduced, horns would be blaring, and drums would be roaring, and Oriki poets whose tongues are washed by the gods.
Yeah, we had that, but Wole didn't
want to. Now, I have to avoid all of that, and in sedate and sober Harvard, I have to do it this way. I am honored to have the opportunity to welcome my longtime friend and compatriot. We are both from good old Nigeria, Wole Soyinka, back to W.E.B. Du Bois Institute. Today, we will have the privilege of hearing him read from his new collection of poetry, Samarkand and Other Markets I Have Known. Wole Soyinka is Africa's most acclaimed writer. In 1986, he became the first African to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. His writing is as much about the complexities of the human condition as it is about the political turmoil in his native Nigeria. From satirical comedy to serious philosophy, Soyinka writes with equal power as a dramatist, poet, and as a novelist. The New York Times Book Review has called his autobiographical work a classic of African autobiography, indeed a classic of childhood memoirs, wherever and whenever produced. About another of his books, The Open Sore of a Continent, a personal narrative of the Nigerian crisis, published in 1997, the Christian Science Monitor had this to say: the trio of essays is passionate, stirring, and chock full of humor and insight. Its theme, whether the nation state, is among the most compelling topics in sub-Saharan Africa and throughout the post-Cold War world. Martin Esslin, you all know, has called Soyinka one of the finest poetic playwrights who have ever written in English. And the Irish Times simply called him a writer of genius. These are just random selections. But if you read around, you find that there's so much that has been said about him. Soyinka's 1975 play, Death and the King's Husband, remains his most widely read and performed work. Among his other many notable publications are A Play of Giants, published in 1984, the novel The Interpreters, published in 1965, and the autobiographical works, Ake, The Years of Childhood, and The Man Died, Prison Notes, published in 1972. This latter work, The Man Died, is an account of his 22 months as a political prisoner in the late 1960s, when he was incarcerated by the Nigerian government during the Civil War. His most recent collection of poetry, which I mentioned earlier, Samarkand and Other Markets I Have Known, was written during a period of exile from Nigeria and was just published last month. Altogether, he's published more than 20 books. These are the official books. These are, they're not the sideline incidental publications. You would be counting in the hundreds. But I'm just the mainline publications, the ones I'm talking about. Now, Soyinka was born in 1934 in Abeokuta, near Ibadan. Abeokuta is the capital of Ogun State in Nigeria, Western Nigeria. His father was headmaster of the Anglican Mission School in the village of Ake, and it was here that Soyinka received his first education, which juxtaposed early Christian training and schooling in traditional Yoruba beliefs and practices. He went on to study at the Government College in Ibadan and then at the University of Leeds, from which he earned a doctoral degree in 1973. From the 1960s on, Soyinka has taught drama and literature at universities in Ibadan, Lagos, and Ife, and he has held a number of visiting professorships in Europe and the United States at institutions including Cambridge University and Yale University. He is currently the Robert W. Woodruff Professor of the Arts at Emory University in Atlanta. In 1995, Wole Soyinka delivered the Du Bois Institute's inaugural Macmillan Stewart Lectures, which were co-sponsored by Oxford University Press. I'm also delighted to say that in academic year 1995-1996, Soyinka was a fellow here at the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute. In 1999, he was named the first distinguished scholar in residence by New York University's Africana Studies and the Institute of African American Affairs. Please join me in welcoming here Wole Soyinka.
Thank you very much. I didn't know a man could be so easily terrorized. Yeah. Because I was present at that famous, or famous international, because he was arriving at the college to find there was still a coda. But I see that this time he wasn't getting any chances at all. But thanks, Iman. As you see, he's very objective. One or two corrections, and I have to say this each time, because I live in a country where it doesn't matter who says what, it eventually comes back to you as having said it. I didn't earn a doctorate from Leeds University. I dropped out after my first degree and hung out in the theatres in London. And eventually Leeds University called me back and gave me an honorary doctorate. So, which is very different from sweating it out like others did. One or two other tiny, tiny details, which I'll deal with you later on. But this one is most important that I announce it in the open, so I can say there are witnesses. I never said. Anyway, it says on the program to read from and discuss his new latest publication. I know it has not been published in the United States, although there are copies, pirated, I'm sure, floating around. Did I mention any names?
No,
I didn't mention any names. I decided to read from this new publication for the simple reason that it's a theme which has been obsessing me. This is a volume of poems in which the majority of the poems really deal with a theme which has become a critical one in our times. And that, to just state it at its most simplistic, is tolerance, extremism. You know, the extremism of ideology, of faith, leading to the most unbelievable, irrational conflicts all over the world. Du Bois said in his time that the problem of the 20th century would be one of race. And he was right. Borrowing from him, I did say, even before we embarked on this new century in Paris, that I felt that the problem of the next century would be one of religious intolerance. And sure enough, a few months after I said that, the first fatwa, international fatwa, was issued against the fellow writer, Salman Rushdie. I'm not trying to say I'm prophetic, I'm just saying that I just looked at the entrails of the latest bushfowl I killed, and I could read very clearly. It's so clear, and that's what we're all undergoing today. You know, fundamentalisms of all kinds, whether from Osama bin Laden or his running mate George Bush. It's all this fundamentalist streak has overtaken all of us, and. And the timing of this anthology for me is just perfect. I'll be reading from Samarkand. This is the English publication, but one of the main poem there, which is Samarkand, I'll be reading from this elegant volume, which does honor to literature everywhere. There are people, you know, who are still primitive enough to believe in bookcraft, and they print these things handcrafted, specially designed. And believe me, the poem looks different when you look at it in this kind of special binding with illustrations. It just makes you want to go on writing some more poetry. So the two things feed from each other. I should tell you that the proceeds from this special edition called Rainmaker Editions actually all the proceeds go towards the establishment and the maintenance of Cities of Asylum network all over the world for persecuted writers, which again has become one of the problems of our times. It's very expensive. I can't even afford one. I'm entitled to just one copy. Some people wanted to snitch this copy, but I had to tell them very firmly that it's my only copy. That's all I'm entitled to. I didn't look anywhere. I'm going to begin, in fact, but at the same time, I want this election to be one of celebration. Why? Simply because, as I was saying the other day in Las Vegas, that I've been feeling rather depressed lately by what's been happening in certain other parts of the world. You also must have felt the shock when you learned of a library being burnt, and an ancient library as that in Baghdad. It's for me a disaster. One even feels guilty, and Skip and I were discussing this. One feels guilty when one admits that somehow it shocks you more than the killing of innocent civilians. I think maybe because we're all aware of mortality, and we know that certain things are supposed to outlast us, outlast human beings. So when you hear of a museum being destroyed, looted, and a library being set on fire, you really feel something's been taken out of you personally, out of your life, even though you've never been there before. I think most people, you know, who in the arts or creative, or who are sensitive in any way, feel that. And so the selection which I have is a selection of celebrations simply because one has to try and transcend these moments of negativity. And so I'll be reading Samarkand, which deals with, intolerance and alternative views of existence away from rigid ideologies of either the secular or the theocratic kind, which for me is a statement of defiance against the Philistinism, which is overtaking us today. Statement that there are still things left to celebrate. And in fact, the very act of literature, of publication, of fine arts books and so on, is a kind of symbolic resistance to these negative events which overtake us. But let me begin with one which is not all that celebrative, just to remind us of where we are today. And I selected this. It's entitled, Where the News Came to Me of the Death of a Tyrant. Where the news came to me of the death of a tyrant. And the news came to me of the death of this tyrant, actually in Jerusalem. That was my first ever visit there. And I stood on the Mount of Olives, also called the Noble Sanctuary by in the Islamic world. And that's when I heard the news that what had been driving me all over the world had finally been removed. And I wondered why the same solution could not take place in some form or the other on this beautiful land, which really is a moving piece of real estate in which the whole red lens of spirituality hits you, whether you believe in one religion or the other. There's something about standing on the tip of the Noble Sanctuary. Where the news came to me of the death of a tyrant. Dusk on Mount of Olives, Noble Sanctuary. I stood, medium of a nation's darkest hour, stranger as so many feet to a sea land peopled also by strangers, journeys shared on legendary paths, epic wells, patriarch cemeteries, rites, reliquaries, and holy sanctuaries, bound at navel, yet strangers sworn to sword. Mine also was the darkest hour of a distant land. No wonder the sinuous plains, far as eyes or mind could capture, ruptured suddenly, filled with sparks of scythe-hopped chariots, impassioned lances, froth-lipped horses in the charge of death, riders, salvation bound in one last holy carnage, the ghosts of old delusions, potent still, reveled in invocation of the sacred word. A time stood still for this birthland of millennia. A blindfold wider than nations and more craved stretched, it seemed, across spires and domes, cross and crescent, toned in the golden haze of dusk, snaked through bronze warrens, spice and leather alleys, date trestles, sandalwood, olive groves and sparse oases, wound through catacombs where piety, praise and wounds. Yet the air was peace, palpable to touch, an eternal presence like a set transparency masking the face of gore, a resolution glimpsed through palimpsests of blood-stained suns. A gift, it proved, a resolution dearly sought. Strife brought me to a warring land where olives detonate in shrapnels, shrivel as infant heads. Hope is split on the axe of history, zeal and politics. Yet one road only leads to Jerusalem, only one, that broad, pebbled spine of human oneness. Pondering war, I trod the sandal-paved stones, senses lulled in light incense, brushed by hems of robes from distant sages, pilgrims of all faiths, and the dark hour beckoned to me in hope. From that seared land that I had sworn I would not leave with empty hands came a gift and a choice to amplify or squander. One tyrant less may spell little, but who scorns the miser's dole of respite, a drop of manna from skies of that same miracle land? One drum of war, at least, was muted. This gift lies heavy on my hands, unrequited. Would I could stay the glimpse of that rare moment when the shrouds of history parted and a vision of hope suffused the plains of the Mount of Olives, noble sanctuary. I move. I move now to celebrate the poem itself, the process of creativity, sort of, because not really to celebrate, but to talk about lost creative pieces. That should be in this chapter. Information. Those of you who are writers, you must from time to time have wondered where a poem you scribbled yesterday disappeared to. And maybe a year later you find scraps of it, and then you wonder what was the rest about? Where is the rest? And so to console myself, because I lose poems the way I lose keys and pens, so to console myself I decided to write a poem to lost poems. I think sometimes of poems I have lost. Maybe their loss it was that saved the world. Still, they do get lost. And I recall them only when a fragment levitates behind discarded invoices, the black-rimmed notice of a last goodbye, a birth, a wedding invitation, and other milestones of a lesser kind. The moment torments, why? Beyond an instant's passion, dubious flash, Satori in a bar, taxi or restaurant, an airport waiting lounge? That births the scribble on a stained napkin? What cast of the ephemeral once resonates, then spurns the mind the morning after? All that survives mimics a wrinkled petal pressed between pages of a long discarded book. A falling leaf trapped briefly by the passing sun, it flashes a mere shard of memory, but filled with wistful accusations of abandonment. Too late, no life to it. The book is closed, the moment's exaltation or despair, drowned in wine rivers, shriveled in suns of greater wars. I turn these scrapbooks of a moment's truth to cinders, curlings curse in smoke, once more fugitive beyond recall of usurper's summons by the morning after. I think of voices I have lost and touches, the fleeting brush of eyes that burrows deep within the heart of need, the pledge unspoken, the more than acts of faith that forge an instant world in silent pact with strangers, deeper, deeper bonds than the dearest love's embrace. And now, let's celebrate food. This poem is dedicated to a friend of mine, late now. Skip knows him, met him. He taught me food. I just used to think that food was something you ate to keep alive, but he was different. When Femi ate in a restaurant, people left their plates to stare at him. Then we'll walk across to shake his hand and sometimes buy him drinks. I mean, he ate with such... I mean, he gave meaning to food. And sometimes I would go out with him in a restaurant. I wouldn't eat because I was watching him all the time. And I would be filled just by watching him. So he taught me to appreciate food. In return, I taught him wine. Business lunch, the bag lady for Femi Johnson. It was an afternoon of indifferent news. The world was still, the world was turbid. The Dow Jones index fell several points or rose to a Wall Street dance. All trading leads to bankruptcy or wealth and there an end. The babble of striped suits launching on expense account left him cold. He only wished his host had chosen differently, feeling lost among the tinkle of glass cubes in iced teas, gurgle of predictable Chardonnay. I have to return to work, well, just another, and the sudden welt of laughter that somehow traced the downward spiral of some absent victim, a hollow victory, or simply a dirty joke. Suddenly, one false note among the staid discordance, a rogue painting lone in the gallery of fakes, ignored, a highlight through the stain of laughters that sought refuge in rendition of the intruder as invisible, barely spied through opacities of bonhomie, joie de vivre. Beneath the false banter, now, what has this place become? I did not see her enter. So still, her gaze implacably wound in thought, yet a laser beam through the noon window. Not quite a tramp, and yet a misfit in her bulbous wrap. A handbag held her secrets, safe in line of vision on the tabletop, to a micro-world of her mobile home without, a shopping cart piled high with a lifetime foraging. Does she feel eyes and shuffling feet and swiveling heads, arrested martinis midway to genteel throats? She does not fidget. No Morse code filters through her feet, cased in soft leather ease to read impatience. An ankle of white socks beneath stovepipe jeans, faded or distressed, she waited. Angle feet, anxiety deprived, mildly wrapped around the table's stem, affirmed her equipoise. Not comfort-seeking, it is just her way of sitting, limbs that find and nuzzle those of a now familiar lover. Awesomely at ease, oblivious to the inner room on which her back was turned, unperturbed by the kaleidoscope without, does she know the Labrador on leash, hind leg raised in wet salute against a cage sapling? Her pebble lenses yield no clue. Her gaze is innocence itself, and when the waiter bends a practiced ear, a face concealing no surprise, her order is precise, assured. As grew the demolition when the rack of lobsters came and tabula rasa turned a rapturous field in one transcendent flash. Then came the love affair, a tease, a foreplay, a realignment of limbs and mock passes with steel nutcrackers over prostrate yet aggressive curvatures. When it came, the crunch was massive. As the silence drawn in turned heads and suspended gestures, eyes turned to floundering fish. Then, claw by claw, she tamed the rash crustacean, probed deep crevices for virgin flesh, teased out sleek slivers inaccessible till then. The dainty prong between her fingers was a tuning fork. And thus it was that sounds of breaking surf overwhelmed a beach of loud sun worshippers, a diviner's stick that plumbed the arid carpers for unsuspected spurts of moisture, liposuctions coming fast but moderated, a narrative of barnacles and limpets, deep sea odysseys, and Neptune's trident playfully at work in lyric fingers. Her face, a surgeon's mask, still soft, an infinite capacity for care and skill sufficiency now assumed the lobster's ruddy glow. Gently, as a beaching craft, she coasted home. Her legs released the prisoner's stem. Hands fell away from conquered plates, heaped shards of shell, self-surmounting in their cream and prickle-red submission. It was plain she, too, had come for business. It was an afternoon of indifferent news. The world was still, the world was turbid. I had great need of a universe that still was peopled, lived, loved, and died, ate and defecated, wrapped its legs around the table's stem. The Labrador on leash returned without a glance at its pliant urinal. Two nursemaids paused by the window, laughed and gossiped as in a silent film. I turned inwards to a room filled suddenly with mouths and throats, enthralled to food as sometime function, saw my face reflected in the wall-length mirror. Chastened now, I gulped my tepid glass of Chardonnay. And in Yoruba tradition, and as well as in many African traditions, all performers salute their either their instruments before they can perform, or their ancestors, forebears, their mentors, parts of their body, their skills, etc., etc. So I'm going to salute, do a little bit of this salutation with a salute to my eyes. The title is Doctored Vision. Have you heard that one before?
No.
No. Submissive to the year's constraints, the poet tries again the optician's expertise. The placard test begins. One eye obeys all semiotic tests. The other blurs the dots, rapes simple arithmetic. The mind can only total what it separates, but spots the gnat slow crawling on the lens's eye. Next, the literacy test. We'll try this board, shall we? Start with the topmost line. The errant eye discerns, at best, a charming alphabestiary. K flaunts wings, R wags a furry tail, H sprouts horns, F is unicorn. Rabbit ears adorn the simple U, while others droop from W. C has long closed ranks. He thinks of flawed O-rings. Am I doomed to crash from vaulting vision? The left eye, boastful, reads in sync the micro-printing on the bottom line, but finds the page close-held, a mindless hieroglyphic smear. The doctor frowns, tugs at his lower lip. His scrutiny suggests a catch. They are both your eyes. I know of no eye transplant in entirety. His sigh is terminal. He tells the poet what other clinics had long diagnosed. Short-sighted in one eye, long on the other. The patient waits. The explosion comes on cue, but not within the limits we call natural. A little difference, that's the norm. But these, sir, belong to different pairs of eyes. Shrunken shanks, hoary head, will I look cute in monocle? The poet plans, he hopes, a veto on the optician's line of thought. I hate bifocals. The doctor's laugh is bitter. Your case, sir, goes beyond bifocal remedy. Christ, do you think I spend 3 hours on every client with eyes like yours? No one could stay in business. A squint would make some sense, because your eyes, sir, are at war with one another. They harmonize at certain magic intervals. Don't ask me how. They are your eyes, not mine, or so you claim. A sharp, derisive snort affirms the doubt. magic intervals. The patient feels consoled, no longer isolated as a visual freak. That sounds poetic, he reflects. Harmonize at certain magic intervals. All other clinics diagnose a bane. None till now has found a virtue in my visual cross. You make it sound akin to poetic vision. The doctor's voice is strained. My cross, sir, is to find the right prescription for your sight. Myopia, astigmatism, etc., those modes of vision fill my register. There is no poetic vision. The buzzer from front desk recalls him to his waiting patients. His shoulders sag. Come back tomorrow. I may summon a second opinion. The receptionist will find a vacant slot, I hope. One slot, best make it three or five. Maybe we should allot one entire morning to your case. Yes, a second opinion. Two heads are better than one. His laugh, the patient thinks, sounds faintly manic. Ha ha, two heads. Yes, in your case, how true. Four eyes, the perfect answer. 16 combinations. That should cover all your magic intervals. Behind the doctor's antiseptic stare, the patient reads experimental lust and flees the clinic, never to return. Today he roams the streets, surviving on his own prescription. One eye patch woven of gossamer skeins from that charmed loom that spun images of new clothes for the emperor. And for the other eye, a conjured prism herding riots of signals into a parsimonious lyric impetus spaced at magic intervals. And now this one, I should provide you, this is the last one. Reading a poem from a book is a different matter from listening to it once. Though that might provide a teaser for you to get the book. But it means that certain references are lost. So what one doesn't do normally, I think I should give you a little bit of a map of this long poem. It is inspired by the incident in Cairo when Naguib Mahfouz was stabbed by some fundamentalists. He survived, of course. His crime was simply for what he wrote. And it sent me back to what I'd always thought, what I'd earlier said about considering the problem of the future of the world to be in terms of tolerance. Fundamentalist extremism of all kinds, of all religions, of all faiths, of all ideologies. There are certain words here which you may not have heard of before. You'd have heard of Krishna, of course, and Hare Krishna, etc., and Buddhism you'll know about, but you wouldn't have heard of, for instance, Orisha. When you encounter the word Orisha, that's a Yoruba deity, and within that pantheon, you'll encounter Ogun, who's the god of metallurgy, of the road, of the lyric, as a contradictory deity, both of creativity and of destruction. You find Shango, who's the god of lightning. Today, Shango presides over the electricity corporation in Nigeria. Much to the distress of that god, you know, who I'm sure by now really should have blasted all those who are in charge of electricity over there. Oya is another, is a female deity. She was very interesting persona, used to be Ogun's wife, found him too belligerent, moved to Shango. I don't know where she ended up. You know, all these gods are very, very interesting. I found them. So then others, Hare Krishna, you know, there's a word, Isaleko. Isaleko is just a region of Lagos, a suburb of Lagos, which is a real Yoruba modern cosmopolitan setting. Some of you may have forgotten, and that's why I think I should remind you of these things, you may have forgotten that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, another monolith of ideological thought which collapsed, there was such an economic crisis that workers, you know, were being paid in produce. You know, they had to go hawking, you know, things which was produced just in order to earn their salaries. I think that reference is important for some of you who might be too young to remember that this did happen. Otherwise, it's just a poem like any other, on the long side. I may have to take a pause from time to time to take a sip of water. I'm just recovering from a cold also, so my voice cracks in the middle, you'll understand. I preface it with two quotations. One, translation of a Yoruba song, or a snatch from a Yoruba song, which says, "The world is a marketplace," which is, of course, where the contributed to the inspiration of the title itself. And the other is, "We take the golden road to Samarkand," which you, some of you remember, is a chorus from Elroy Flecker's play, Hassan. And I visited Samarkand once, which will explain why I thought of Samarkand after this incident where Naguib Mahfouz was stabbed in the neck. A market is kind haven for the wandering soul or the merely ruminant. Each stall is shrine and temple, magic cave of memorabilia. Its passages are grottos that transport us, bargain hunters all from pole to antipodes, annulling time, evoking places and lost histories. A market is where Samarkand invades Johannesburg, and as the shutters close, departs without regrets or trace until its next reincarnation. A market is where London's Portobello spells Caracas and Yoruba, Catalan or Curacan, and though hard currency is what changes hands, it lets you drift in fluid channels where sensations thrive on trade by barter. Chimes of faith assail the marketplace, the muezzin's prayer alert, a shrine within the warren. A lean-to church dispenses chants at war with handbells. White-robed dervishes in trance at crossroads of spices row and fabric lanes swirl, oblivious to slender saffron files meandering, equally oblivious to the world. Fairy bells in counterpoint to cosmic ohms, Hare Krishna's other dervishes in slight ethereal motion through the fireward stalls, deep in the maze of Isaleko, Buddhist mantras. The Orisha faithful wait their turn. In season, Ogun's iron bells, Shago's iron drums, Oya's chalk and coral maids reclaim this borrowed space. Ancestral voice ascendant, masks of wood and webbed vices, indigo and camwood presences unfold their mats of invocation. These are the markets I have known. Tibetan souls on pilgrimage to shrines in heartlands of Dogon, Baule, or Zululand. Leaflets of salvation for the unwary, barefoot evangelists of every faith, tuned to bear moments of the vacant soul. Let all contend. Let 100,000 flowers diffuse exotic incense and 1,000,000 stars perfume the sky till the infant cry of truth resounds in the market of the heart and warring faiths reconcile in one immensity of being. Trade in holy places, saints and salesmen have ever lived as soul companions, caterers for the needs of flesh and spirit, bread and wafer, wine and holy water, homilies, talismans and rosaries, the blessed pouch of earth or magic mantras, locks and lockets of painted mystics, reliquaries and tourist souvenirs around a healing spring, a spot of revelation. The pilgrim trade is evenly sanctified. Still, here and there, one lashes out. Recall the Prince of Peace, turned manic in his synagogue, turned marketplace, lashed trespassers with tongue and whip. That lash, in retrospect, was kind. I envy the usurers of old the wages of their sin and mine. Our season's lesser desecrations, a face unveiled, an ankle bared, a keepsake taste or thought of foreign taint, feed grim reaper purity from lethal thrusts. Not the symbolic clash. They pierce the heart, not touch the soul within. Go to the Orisha and be wise. Ifa shuns the excluding tongue, unveils uncharted routes to knowledge, truth, and godhead. Man is restless seeker. What follows six, says Ifa, transcends the bounds of seven. There are no final rites to numerology. Let who can count the motes in a sunbeam, or weigh the span of grief from voice to voice in the home of the immolated. Go to the Orisha. None but fools claim guardianship of the final gateway. Now, take a hidden turn between the stalls. A curtain parts. The wares within are never on display, ranged out of sight, awaiting clientele that know the secret maps of every marketplace. Fumes that ransack, then bear the mind to ecstasies unknown in ancient Samarkand. These seekers also ply uncharted routes to the outer markets of the world, dissolving sunspots trapped in pinpoints of their eyes, regaining wholeness only they know where. Tubes and needles reign supreme. The crucible is sacrament and host to cravings when the makeshift stove is lit. Or enter where the sheen on beaten brass gives way to a glint on the Gatling gun, still serviceable. A shoulder-held dispatcher, lethal cone on end, and oil wraps masking ingenuities that pave the shortest way to hell. Still, hell's location is a space of choice. In open air, Dante weds Fayed on ancient trestles, brown with age, pages still uncut, as if to hide profanities of afterlife, as dreamed by poets and lunatics, moralists and lovers. A slumbering virgin, timeless, but her youth preserved, and you the wandering prince to whom her thighs slit open for gentle ravishing. And Samarkand, oh Samarkand, I cannot stroll through markets, but I dread lest I see Samarkand again, yet long to see how exchange has merged with change, see if the ageless geese on tattered slippers in Utopia, the lumpen prole, midwives of new breed of being, named the world's inheritors, have at last metamorphosed into princesses and masters of the promised land. Such feeble scarecrows to my market manners of Accra, Abidjan, Huambo, Cairo, Ibadan, plump mistresses of markets, routers, fair, queens of fiesta, theatrix, courts of arbitration, crash, but wait, I summon witnesses to counter cries of buyers. Randy Weston, Oscar Peterson, hear them celebrate Nigerian marketplace, keyboards wild and wind on fire, and strangers' brushes daubing oil for dyes in vain to trap the market's rainbow spectrum, bear the weight of human tumult and the smell of life. It's there I pictured him, Mahfouz, his soul in tune with priests and peddlers of the souk. So much for ancient times. Today the strings are muted. Samarkand's sibling markets on these continents have fallen to dry dirges, dropped to thin laments beneath collapsing thatch. To make a killing on the market now may prove too literal, where zealots strut as middlemen to market lords of unseen paradise. Oh, Samarkand. Remember Samarkand? It was that time of utopia by the text. Eagerly, we crowded on the promise of a legend, found a straw masquerade, the terminus of party lies, inhuman patience that began in Moscow's streets and wound through regulations and officialdom to stagnate in Flecker's land of dreams. There were no chants extolling market wares. The bloom we sought in peasant cheeks was lodged in hordes of produce, crushed against deep warehouse vaults. Tubers, pears, deep purple aubergines, ponderous cabbages and lean spices. Destination, party ranks and dachas by the sea. The shine we sought upon their skin was locked in racked tomatoes, straight from still life canvases, in melon sphericals like new discovered worlds. A wild assault of rare, exotic fruits flared our questing nostrils, mocked the mien of stiff official guides, breezes from a different time and place. We did ask questions, received responses by the text. Joy had fled the faces of the eternal women. They lined the market outskirts silently, winter twigs, dark shadows framed in rags, limp greens outstretched, limp socks and shawls, the regulation surplus they could hawk at will for those few kopecks they could call their own. A market and no human sounds. We bade adieu to Samarkand. We shared the train that hauled our missing prize to Moscow's hidden stores. From frying pan to furnace, from slough of despond to turbid ponds named law of market forces that makes the outlaw bullfrog of the bog, I dread a mafia kingdom where Samarkand is but another tame protectorate, yet on parade as a consumer's paradise, where one will yearn for those bedraggled hands of dead utopia. Their merchandise was theirs to make and sell. Their leisure moments knit the shawl and spun the lace, carved the likeness or grotesque of dreams. Each offering was a flight from drudgery, a cunning hour, defiant of lies, of regulations that imposed conformity. At worst, a pittance end, an elixir of escape. I spurn this double counterfeit. Wages earned in goods from plant assemblage, brassieres, jars of mayonnaise, jockstraps, plated cutlery, diapers, negligees and curtain rods, shaving creams, deodorants, tourist wares, the ever-replicating babushkas, where barter is debased and leisure must be shared in after hours, converting wages merchandise to a common currency devalued from the source. O Samarkand, your workers must prove traders too. Accosting strangers, plying second-tier exchange, lest the home be starved. Oh, Samarkand, what bargain you have made. Utopia sold for this. Will Chernobyl pay wageless scientists in enriched uranium to solve the states of insolvency? Or maybe, as Allah wills, since soul and sail have ever shared their space, Samarkand will turn the other sort, twin face of that tarnished paradise whose source for goose was not for gander. We bid adieu to culotte, comprador, bourgeois, deviationist, revisionist, capitalist, running dog, false consciousness, and allied gulag overtures that masked the silent guest in every home. That doomsday noise is stilled. New heroes of the revolution hail the anointed text, now simplified, that reads, holy or unclean. Taboos proliferate. Like the bazaars of Beirut, Algiers, or Tehran, will a store display an order form, satanic music, poster, a fable on a tapestry, a catalogue of books, second-hand merchandise, a dog-eared copy of Arabian Nights, a pamphlet poem, prove the trader's violent passport into paradise. The bazaars of the souk may prove denuded, the magic carpet folded out of sight in dread. There may be new commissars on patrol, messengers between the laity and deity. The scrambled word that passes censorship is kill. Kill the unveiled, for the word is veiled to all but the anointed few dacoits of deity. They sanctify the blade, still dripping from its last jihad. It carves a path through an old man's neck, but the moving finger writes, though the ink of Kandahar has turned to blood. The heir of ancient dynasties of letters, Khorasan, Alexandria, Timbuktu, lies sprawled in the dirt and dust of a passageway. He is no alien. No roots than his grow deeper in that marketplace. No eye roved closer home. He is that fixture in the marketplace cafe, sipping sweetened cups of mint, oblivious to the bitter one that would be served by the shadowy one, the waiter stalker, a youth fed on dreams of sarabands, of houris, doe-eyed virgins, wine and sweetmeats in the afterlife. But to this paradise, a key, the plunging knife. It's time to raise the rafters. Time to chant the primal sanctity of man, beyond coarse politics, beyond meagerness of race and faith. Time to disinherit nationhood episcopacies. We declare this questing biped heir to cosmic legacies. Who kills for love of God, kills love, kills God. Who kills in name of God, leaves God without a name. The marketplace of hate is squatted on the pious tongue. But this the old man knew, yet kept his daily tryst with haggling cries, mock wars of merchandise, mint tea and gossip, an avocation to observe and chronicle. He shares the dreams of Samarkand with traders and the traded, with sinners and the sinned against, with infidels and the self-assured of paradise. A dream that never ends, a glimpse that still recedes, that shimmering golden road to Samarkand. The ocean meets the sea in the marketplace, and rivers ground their debris on its shelves, rich silt, beachcombers' treasure trove. The rainbow's arc is rounded in the marketplace, where scattered tribes of a busy world unite. Amidst the silence, blades of swords and spears and ancient muskets, poison shafts and knobkeries. Like guardians to that lost miraculous edition, filled with lost wisdoms, lost journeys of the mind, the space of dreams remain inviolate, egalitarian in the marketplace, though desecration stalks in priestly garb by surrogates, by one-eyed arbiters. But now we share the strange and marvelous, indulge in thoughts of origin. We people artifacts from ivory, skin and herbs, from aromatic wood, sifts of powder guaranteed for ailments old and new, dark mysteries in clay gels, in clay jars, beauty gels, love potions, the lost gems of the world, and many more with fake luster, fake patina, like fake piety, the exact veneration. Still, in the marketplace, their patina is peace. And though innocence be sometimes lost or counterfeited, we share the gods of distant lands, of ancient times, and the market muse by whose decree the knives are sheathed and guns are mostly spiked or fallen silent. You who have heard the ocean waves, or the cries of dead mariners from bleached muteness of shell and conch, learn also other sounds beneath the market wares and haggling voices. Siren songs from coral beads, a child's initiation wail in barks of camwood, a priest's liturgy in rosaries of sandalwood, a chieftain's ululation in horsetail whisks and beaded canes. Dirges of bereavement seep through ancient mats, the orca-smeared antique or a faded photograph. The frame of tarnished silver will be home soon to a stranger's face in an alien household, and thus we jostle strangers who turn guests and kin. The market is that kind of meeting place. The world is a marketplace, thus goes the song. At close of market, in the somber light, our feet will lead the way homewards when eyes have closed forever on the next market day, and the indigo throng of all Orisha wait to lead each seeker by the hand into that last sanctuary across the arch of shadows. One market day, in the souk of Cairo, the zealot's counterfeiting hand did not triumph. The moving finger writes, and having writ, the mind survives to sing the way on the golden road where dreams of Samarkand outlive tomorrow's market day. Thank you.
So that concludes this week's edition of Domo Tech. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation of the spoken word. You've, of course, been listening to the work of Wole Soyinka, playwright, poet, winner of the 1986 Nobel Prize. He was reading from his work, Samarkand and Other Markets I Have Known, from a YouTube video.
Did you undergo a strip search at Riviere des Prairies or Bordeaux detention centers between October 11, 2016 and March 20, 2020? If so, you could receive up to $2,000 per eligible strip search. Hurry, you have until March 5th, 2024 to fill out the claim form. Visit proactio.ca/searches or call us at 1-866-369-5118 to check your eligibility and fill out a claim form.
This is Phone Doc.
And this mess stinking.
When we ain't chilling up in the bricks in the chalet, we chilling out here in Montreal.
On CKUT.
Nobody do it better, dog.
90.3 FM.
Gone.
Hey, Black, you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Did you undergo a strip search at Riviere des Prairies or Bordeaux detention centers between October 11, 2016 and March 20th, 2020? If so, you could receive up to $2,000 per eligible strip search. Hurry, you have until March 5th, 2024 to fill out the claim form. Visit proactio.ca/searches or call us at 1-866-369-5118 to check your eligibility and fill out a claim form.
Show pour le monde. Stone.
Bonsoir mesdames et messieurs, vous êtes à l'antenne de CKUT 90,3. Vous écoutez Show pour le Monstone, édition du 14 septembre 2023. Nicolas Thérien avec vous, je serai votre Sherpa pour cette première heure d'escalade du Monstone. Vers 22h, notre ami François Letourneau, mon co-animateur, va probablement débarquer soit en montgolfière, soit grâce à un canon. Il va se faire catapulter sur le flanc de la montagne et il va venir prendre ma relève pour vous accompagner de 22h à 23h au sommet du Monstone ce soir, et je sais que son émission s'annonce aussi excellente que la mienne, sinon meilleure, alors je vous invite à rester jusqu'à 23h. Dans cette première heure, je vais vous faire entendre une variété de choses. On va avoir un long segment pour commencer dans un instant de Violent Onsen Geisha, truc complètement expérimental que j'ai découvert cette semaine. On va entendre des grands extraits de l'album Otis, puis après ça, des musiques de films,